Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry, and more than a million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true. When you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living's going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Puriza, London.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said it seems AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saeed Purizap, London.
The Israeli military shut down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about expose the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and of course also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful.
The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries, and an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
While UK Conservative leadership candidates Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak are committed to the UK's legally binding target for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, both want to curtail solar power and onshore wind farms and support fracking and increase fossil fuel production. While Rishi Sunak has promised government support for Insulation 2, neither has set out a detailed plan on the issue or on net zero generally. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey under the heading, Think Tank Says Tory Leadership Candidates Failing on Net Zero Policies. A right-leaning think tank has warned that the two UK Conservative leadership candidates are failing to promise the policies needed to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions, despite a clear need for measures that would cut consumer bills as well as carbon emissions. According to a proposal from Onward, insulating Britain's drafty homes would cost the government just over £1 billion a year in grants, plus a similar amount in subsidised loans, while a 50% cut in the stamp duty could encourage people to install low-carbon heat pumps when they move homes. Ministers could also increase the uptake of electric vehicles and other green technologies through salary sacrifice schemes, and reduce the number of car journeys through nudges such as personalised public transport plans that inform people of their local public transport timetables and cycle routes. However, while both Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak are committed to the UK's legally binding target of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, both want to curtail solar power and onshore wind farms and support fracking and increase fossil fuel production. While Rishi Sunak has promised government support for Insulation 2, neither has set out a detailed plan on the issue or on net zero generally. Alex Luke, author of the Onward report, said it was natural that the candidates were focused on immediate issues such as the cost of living crisis, but said the quest for net zero must be a key priority for the next Prime Minister. Alex Luke said both candidates claim they are committed to the net zero target, but we need to hear more from both of them on how exactly they will do that. Alex Luke added, it's clear that retrofit of homes for energy efficiency will need to be a massive part of reaching the net zero target. He pointed out that polling showed net zero was still a top five issue for most Tory voters and a top four issue for the wider public. The Onward report, Going Green, which will be published in the coming days, found that an insulation program for 15 million households offering a combination of government grants and loans subsidized with very low interest rates through the government's infrastructure bank would cost the Treasury about £31 billion in total by 2050, plus another £40 billion in total by 2075 in subsidising low-interest rate loans. Homeowners who save about £20 a month on their bills after the cost of repaying the loans each month at current energy prices, and far more if prices leap again, as expected this autumn and next spring. Alex Luke said a previous attempt to do this, the Green Deal programme introduced under the coalition government but scrapped in 2015, had failed owing to astronomical market-based interest rates of more than 10%, which meant people barely saw any overall saving. Onward also suggested that nudges could play a key role in changing consumer behaviour, which will be needed to reach net zero emissions. Alex Luke said local authorities could offer personalised transport and commute plans. He pointed to a trial in Ipswich, Suffolk, costing £27 a person, which gives personalised information on public transport, walking and cycling routes, which resulted in an 11% fall in car journeys and a 14% increase in walking and cycling. Alex Luke adds, "None of these nudges are a panacea or an excuse for not thinking seriously about investment in reaching net zero emissions, but they are small-scale interventions that are low-cost, that have an impact and bring about changes." The government pulled the plug on its incentives to buy electric cars earlier this year, resulting in an uncertain outlook for the sector. According to Alex Luke, take-up of the cars had increased markedly, but they are likely to remain more expensive to buy than fossil fuel cars for the next decade. A government spokesperson claimed, "The United Kingdom is leading the world on climate change. We have driven down emissions by 44% since 1990, whilst growing our economy more than any other G7 country, and are taking action to help people make greener choices." He asserted, "We have committed over £6.6 billion to decarbonise homes and buildings, which includes a £450 million boiler upgrade scheme to increase the uptake of heat pumps. Further, we have invested £2.5 billion to accelerate the rollout of zero-emission vehicles and charging infrastructure across the country. Furthermore, as concerns over climate, pollution and biodiversity have been largely absent from the United Kingdom leadership debates, the Green Party has warned the two candidates to be the UK's next Prime Minister must commit to much tougher environmental targets and environmental policies. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have both confirmed their commitment to the UK's legally binding target of reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, but have given little indication of how they would go about this goal. Adrian Ramsey, the co-leader of the Green Party, warned that the United Kingdom was already living beyond its means on the environment by consuming far more resources than the planet could sustain, damaging nature beyond its capacity to recover and emitting far more carbon dioxide than could be absorbed by trees, seas and soils. Policy pronouncements by the two leadership candidates so far have focused on the economy and issues such as immigration. But Ramsey says pursuing economic growth at all costs was not possible without damaging the Earth's life support systems. He warned just recently, the United Kingdom witnessed the hottest temperatures on record and the consequence of climate disruption became clear for all to see. As wildfires raged and people lost everything as their homes were burnt on the ground, the two candidates to become our next prime minister were talking more about economic growth than tackling the climate crisis. Ramsay called for a shift away from standard economic measures, such as gross domestic product, which rewards the overuse of resources and fails to account for factors such as people's well-being and people's happiness. Ramsay said, "Unfortunately, successive governments have for too long focused on economic growth at all costs, without acknowledging that it's the quality of our economy that matters most, not just the quantity. A narrow focus solely on economic growth will exacerbate the climate crisis and worsen social inequalities." Many economists are unhappy with gross domestic product as the sole benchmark of success in the economy and have called for a broader suite of measures that would take into account people's well-being and the impact of human activities on the planet. Ramsay said making changes to the way the United Kingdom's success was measured would benefit everyone. He said this requires a shift away from chasing economic growth only and instead measuring the success of our economy by how it maximises people's happiness without exceeding planetary boundaries. It also means policies to tackle the scourge of inequality and ensure we share the Earth's resources fairly. He also pointed to estimates of Earth Overshoot Day, the date when humanity has used all the biological resources that the planet can regenerate within a year. All resources used beyond this point are beyond what the Earth can naturally sustain, and all carbon dioxide emitted from this point is not absorbed but pours into the atmosphere to keep heating the planet for up to a century. Ramsay said, "I'm calling on the Conservative leadership candidates to commit to broadening their focus from economic growth and show how they will ensure that the UK lives within our planetary means within the next 10 years. He added, "Our government should be working across the board to ensure we're leading the way on pushing back Earth Overshoot Day further every year."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Israeli army stormed the headquarters of seven Palestinian NGOs in Ramallah and declared them closed. The move came after the military designated these organizations as terror groups. This is while the NGOs have accused Israel of seeking to silence criticism and human rights violations against Palestinians. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the NGOs are right in their accusations against Israel, or is Israel justified in the closures of these NGOs?
The Israeli military shut down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations, they are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about, exposed the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes, will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful. The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us for this program, Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joins us from Edinburgh. We also have Kevin Barrett, an author and Middle East expert, joining us from Madison. Mick Napier, I'll first start with you. Welcome to you both, however. Mick Napier, we are looking at Israel shutting down seven Palestinian NGOs, in which Israel said the groups had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which it says has carried out attacks against Israelis. Do you see any justification in Israel shutting down these seven NGOs?
Well, connected, associated with, these are the vaguest terms possible. Look, when they do this, then the focus has shifted to basically an evidence-free debate and discussion about whether these Palestinian NGOs are terrorists. The allegation's ludicrous, but the actual allegation being made and being picked up in the media around the world shifts the focus away from Israel's terroristic behavior, mass incarceration, shootings, house demolitions, and so on, and takes us from a focus on real violations of human rights and terrorism to a fantasy allegation of of terrorism. Because these organizations, their work is recognized by European Union bodies. They receive some funding in order to tell the truth, in order to research and to report on Israel's crimes, mass incarceration, shoot to kill, and so on. So although it's preposterous, it's very similar to the campaigns in Western countries where allegations of, without any evidence, that people who are pro-Palestine are anti-Semitic, however absurd, takes the discussion away from what Israel is doing, and that's the whole purpose of it. They expect certain organizations in the West to condemn this. Nobody will take any punitive action against Israel, but also Israel's allies will go silent. They'll be quiet about this because it's completely indefensible. And even those people who rarely speak up for human rights, who might be prepared even to condemn Saudi Arabia for a crime against this young woman, I mean, preposterous and savage, they will remain silent with these in the face of these attacks against Palestinian NGOs. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is the Western governments which support Israel will condemn resistance of any form from the Palestinians, whether that be armed resistance or political non-violent resistance. You know, I'm reminded of when Tony Blair called for the release of one single prisoner which the Palestinians had taken from the occupation forces, while thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli dungeons, he called not for their release at all, even those who were denied even the fig leaf of a trial. So one rule for the Israelis, one rule for the Palestinians, and although the Israelis can do no wrong in the eyes of Tony Blair and Boris Johnson and Biden, really it seems as if the Palestinians can do no right, however noble, however self-sacrificing, however justified by the evidence, is the work of these excellent NGOs. So excellent that it's recognized even by parts of governments in Europe, okay, which are Israeli allies.
Yeah, exactly. But they have come out, and they have, these European countries actually, Kevin Barrett, have come out, and they have condemned, they haven't condemned, I take that back, I have to be very careful here, the words, or the way they describe it, deeply concerned. As they said, a worrying reduction of space for civil society. But it's interesting that they have come out somewhat harshly critiquing what Israel has done, because Israel has said these declared organizations receive large sums of money from European countries using a variety of forgery and deceit. So that doesn't quite go together with the way that the European countries have reacted. What's your reading into that?
Well, the European countries know very well that these are totally respectable human rights groups that are complying with all kinds of Western standards and norms and basically kowtowing to the whole Western neoliberal ideology, which poses as the one and only supreme arbiter and defender of all forms of human rights, which is what gives it its supposed monopoly on legitimacy throughout the entire world. You know, this is a hegemonic ideology that the West uses to dominate the rest of the planet. And so these European groups are actually not displeased to have Palestinians echoing that ideology. And so they do support this kind of work to a certain extent, as I suppose they should. But then when the Israelis reveal the complete hollowness and the sham of the way this ideology of human rights actually gets applied on the ground in occupied Palestine, where the Palestinians are being subjected to nonstop terrorism and genocide, then, of course, the Europeans simply whimper a bit and say that they're a little bit concerned and so on and so forth, but they do nothing that actually prevents the Israelis from shutting these organizations down and from continuing to commit the kinds of terrorist crimes and atrocities and slow-motion genocide which these groups have been documenting. So there's a kind of built-in hypocrisy to the system the so-called world community, so the self-styled world community, which is actually a neoliberal global takeover project run from the biggest banks in London and New York, those folks are using liberalism and human rights discourse as their excuse for what they do. And in fact, the reality is that these people who uh-huh. rule the world from their bank offices are the world's worst violators of human rights, and they're supporting this terrorism and genocide in Palestine. And so the human rights groups that speak out supposedly lukewarmly defending what these groups that got shut sure. down are doing are just playing their role in a much larger drama.
Well, I'm a bit confused here, McNabb, here, because if I understood you correctly, you said that the European countries are not as vocal, but it seems like they are on this case when you have these countries like Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden, the nine European Union countries. They are saying that these actions are not acceptable, and they have cited a lack of evidence for what Israel has done, and furthermore, they said that they are not going to actually abide by what Israel has decided to do. It's interesting that they're coming out and they're actually being vocal about this, but where were they when you had over 16 Palestinian children and women who were killed in the recent Israeli war? Why don't they speak about those types of things and atrocities when they occur?
I mean, exactly. Exactly. Look, Israel is a kind of attack dog in the Middle East for the West, for America and Europe. A kind of insurance policy if any local governments become too independently minded. But sometimes the attack dog goes too far and it kind of turns around and bites the person holding the lead. And, you know, Macron and others don't like it when Israel steals foreign aid, for aid to the Palestinians, which the EU has donated, which happens quite often, or attacks clients or allies of the EU inside the Palestinian movement. Israel's going too far. Some of them, I mean, the relationship can sometimes be a little bit tense because some of the Western chancelleries think that Israel's gone a little bit crazy and they'll be prepared to criticize them. But when push comes to shove, as your other speaker has said, and as you've said, when push comes to shove, they remain silent when Israel massacres Palestinians, and therefore to be annoyed, to be critical of what Israel's done now is very, very feeble indeed. Look, essentially, these Palestinians have set up NGOs which try to incorporate Western values in order to say to the Europeans, look what we are doing. It's within your system of values. Therefore, you should support us. But this misses a key point. You know, there were some North American Indians, native people, who adopted Christianity, thinking that this would protect them from being dispossessed. But the land was wanted. The settlers wanted the land, and it made no difference how the natives behaved. They were surplus to requirements, and they had to be ethnically cleansed. Uh-huh. And it's the same with the Palestinians. Even if they behave in the best traditions, the traditions of Swedish social democracy, they are surplus to Israeli requirements, and nothing they can do will exempt them from the Zionist plan to expel them from Palestine, and until that becomes possible, to make life as difficult as possible. So this fits into the Zionist playbook. But it also fits into the occasional criticisms you get from Europe of sure. Israeli excesses.
Well, looking at the U.S. side, Kevin Barrett, the U.S. has actually, through a spokesperson, said that you need to give us some good reasons. The U.S. has said to Israel, you need to give us some reasoning behind this. And Israel has said, well, because they're associated with a terrorist organization, PFLP, and also them calling some of these NGOs terrorist entities themselves. You had 20 members of U.S. Congress actually saying that Biden administration should reject these designations. But that goes against the most recent trip that Biden made to Israel, where it pledged to shield Israel from accountability when it comes to, for example, the ICC or at the UN. So these two don't go together, do they?
Well, no, there's a difference here, a split in the ruling elite between people like Biden, who basically is forced to dance the tune of the Zionist power gates, the White House, the national security constitutions of the deep government, and these people who get elected in sort of left-leaning districts in various big cities of places like Detroit, Minneapolis, and so on. These people in Congress are much more willing to actually kind of walk the walk with the human rights ideology and recognize what's really going on in occupied Palestine and speak a little bit of truth about it every now and then. So, yeah, there is that split, and it leads to kind of different noises coming from different ends of the Democratic Party. But Biden has proved by his rhetoric against the Saudis and so on when he was running for office, and then his behavior when he goes and kisses the ring of Mohammed bin Salman, and then also the Zionist leadership, that he is just as much a pawn and a puppet of those leaders as any other American president. And unfortunately, it's always going to be that way because the U.S. is not a democracy. It's an oligarchy run by a deep state, ultimately run by the people who print the money. And those people are ethnically and otherwise tied to the genocidal regime in Tel Aviv. And they're going to keep on running the world the way they see fit until we manage to rise up and overthrow them, which is what we should all be working on at every moment.
Well, looking at the NGOs, McNabb here, they worked in fields like human rights, of course, prisoner support, or children's rights and healthcare, but these three particular ones that I first stated are issues that Israel has a problem with. They detain children, they're poor on their human rights, obviously, and of course, when it comes to prisoners, we know what's going on with that. So do you think this was a targeted act by Israel in order to shut them down and overall trying to silence any type of critique that may be leveled against them or reporting of human rights violations that are occurring in the occupied territories?
Oh, yes. I mean, from the Israeli side, there's no mystery. Israel wants to close down Palestinian society. It wants to kill those who resist by armed means, and it wants to jail anybody who resists politically. I mean, if you want to tell the truth about what happened to the Palestinians in 48, if you want to agitate for the democratic rights that are the official ruling ideas in Britain and America and so on, the right to live wherever you want in an area and so on, if you have the money, that's called incitement. So actually talking about your rights is a crime in Israel. It's very difficult, and it's something which the Western elites constantly struggle with. How can they whitewash Israel, given that what Israel is doing runs counter to their official ideas? They always manage to succeed. Look, when Biden was in Palestine last time, the Americans were asked about Shireen Abu Akleh, murdered by an Israeli sniper. Everybody knows who killed him. The dogs in the street know who killed Shireen Abu Akleh. But for the Americans, there's no smoking gun. They covered up even that. Not by saying Israel didn't do it, but by saying we can't be sure. So there's no limit to how America and the European Union will protect Israel. But sometimes Israel goes a little bit too far, and sometimes some elements in our governments, politicians think that the attack dog the leash has to be tugged. They have to be told who's the master here. So I think that's what we're seeing. Almost everything that attack dog does will be defended or will be greeted with complete silence if it's indefensible. But from time to time, there will be mild criticism, as long as there is no question of sanctions and punishment of Israel to accompany those criticism. That's the golden rule, which unites politicians right across Europe and North America, with a very, very few honorable exceptions.
Well, to zoom in a little bit more about these NGOs, since we haven't, one of them, Kevin Barrett, is by the name of Adamir, which follows the basis criminalization of organizations where the international community failed to hold Israel accountable, in which it says that, for example, Israel has encouraged, if not provoked, Israel to go after it. Or another one, such as Al-Haq, of which it has said that in that case,
when it guides the families of prisoners that it's providing support. Maybe Israel is paranoid about these organizations for one reason or another, and it went after shutting them down in these numbers because it maybe wants to increase the violations against Palestinians. Could that be a possibility?
Well, yeah, Israel, of course, doesn't want to face any kind of opposition as it runs roughshod over the rights of Palestinians. And these kinds of groups like Al-Haq that organize with the Palestinian prisoners actually help maintain morale among those resistance people, you know, people who are demonstrating, people who are one way or another resisting this genocide. And the fact that there are these kinds of organizations that try to work on their behalf, that try to give some kind of voice to their plight in the world, no matter how restricted that voice is, at least that there's a certain amount of efficacy in terms of helping the world understand what's going on. And so they are seen as obstacles and impediments to the Zionist genocide project. And in fact, the Zionists, in some ways, I think, fear this kind of activity even more than they fear most forms of armed resistance, because at this point, most of the paths to successful armed resistance are at least temporarily blocked. But there is this huge contradiction between the West's obsession with human rights and what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine. And so groups like these that are building bridges to the Western human rights groups are seen as a threat in the medium and long term by the Zionists in terms of the way that the public opinion has been affected. Even Jewish public opinion here in the United States has radically changed over the past generation. Now the younger Jewish Americans are vastly more skeptical about the Zionist entity. I think there was a poll showing that over a third of them agree that Israel is committing genocide and is an apartheid state. So the Zionists see they're losing legitimacy, and shutting down these organizations may be a desperate attempt to try to shore up their legitimacy by silencing those who are questioning it.
My last question does go for another one of these organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, McNapp here, in less than a minute. This is an organization that is for children's rights. I'm looking at the activities, and Israel has called its members terrorists for protecting and defending Palestinian children's rights. Can you see any logic in there? Less than a minute, please.
No logic whatsoever. Israel has to cover up what it does to the greatest extent possible. It has to repress public opinion across Europe and North America, which is increasingly hostile, as our guest has pointed out, to what Israel does. And the task of repressing that public opinion together with governments, that is made more difficult by Al-Haq and by Defense for Children International. When Israel kills 551 children during Operation Protective Edge, when it killed all those to shut down DCI, they have to do it because they fear what these organizations can do in informing Western public opinion.
Thank you very much for that. Mick Napier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity.